They say the guy did it from California. So that must move pretty quick across the diameter of the sun. The space station is moving so quick. So if this happens on a regular basis, all right, the space station is large, but there are plenty of satellites up there. Maybe they're seeing very small dots crossing the surface of the sun. Back to you, WS.
Yeah, those pictures of the International Space Station silhouetted against the surface of the sun. If you choose the right place on the ground, the right time of the day, the right orbit of the International Space Station, you can catch one of those pictures. And it's got to be a very fast picture, and they usually do it by carefully choosing the location, carefully choosing the timing, and then setting the camera in the multi-frame per second mode. And if they're real lucky, they'll catch two of those frames with the space station in the solar disk. The space station goes across the disk in about a third of a second. So you've got to be taking quite a few frames per second to hope that one or two of the frames will catch it. It's a very brief observation. If you're doing it with the naked eye, you would not be able to resolve it. No matter how good your scope is, it is moving so fast, your eye wouldn't be able to scan and focus that rapidly. A fast taking a picture, you do stand a chance. So objects that drift across the sun that are opaque and round and take multiple seconds, it's not a function of what they're smoking. You choose people who are sufficiently objective, who have done enough solar observing. They have seen these things. And you ask the question the correct way. People are afraid to discuss this because it's got all kinds of crazy implications. Over you for any comments on this one, Paul. WS2N, K2LIW.
Hey, mate.
Okay, go ahead, Craig.
Nice thing. This guy must have been pretty good. He got five shots in crossing the sun, so he had a very fast camera. Back to you, Dick. No further comments.
You got it, Craig.
Yeah, don't forget, you also have the ability to shoot high-resolution video, 60 or 120 fields per second. You have the photons there. It's not like, you know, they're going to be long exposure, you know, compiling images that have to get stacked. You're shooting the brightest object we can, you know, focus on. So I would even say 120 would be slow. I would shoot that as fast as the equipment I have. I mean, you have the ability to purchase 6 and 12 megapixel cameras that can take 60 field video for under $1,000 to quickly put a snoot on it to stick in a 2-inch eyepiece is not, you know, adds another $40 there, Dick. So you just got to know when to push start and then know when to push stop. Back to you.
Yeah, to be in the right spot at the right time with the scope aimed the right way and the camera running at the right speed, that's all calculatable ahead of time. You know exactly when it's going to cross your meridian. And so catching the International Space Station silhouetted against the sun, that's an attractive thing to do, and it's a good proof of your ability to do some pretty good celestial calculations and a pretty good setup of equipment to do it. And so I guess we've covered that subject enough for tonight. I won't give you my speculations as to what could possibly be going on with these things, but you talk to enough people who have done enough lunar and solar observing, a certain percentage of them have seen these objects. And most of them have just said, oh, it's a satellite. And they completely forget about the fact that the timing and the size for most satellites does not fit the scenario. And they say, well, it was probably an airplane. Well, in the case of an airplane, a terrestrial airplane, you'll almost always observe details of wings and fuselage and tail structure and so on. A naked eye looking at an aircraft flying at maximum altitude can easily resolve, if a good eye can easily resolve the wings on an airplane. And even if the airplane is one of the super ones that can fly at 80,000 feet, you can resolve, a naked eye will resolve those wings and that fuselage. It's not going to be a round object. So airplanes don't fit very well. I guess it's time for a space report, Paul. WS2N, with space report number 243. What's NASA and the other space agencies doing over the last week, and what are they about to do? You've got it, Paul. K2LAW in the TechNet.
Yeah, there's a lot of odd and things going on. Even today, the Dragon came back from the International Space Station. It undocked earlier today, and then it landed in the Pacific Ocean near Baja, California, with probably about 4,000 or 5,000 pounds worth of scientific equipment that came back. Right now, they're the only ones that can bring back large amounts of stuff from the space station. So that was pretty good. They launched early in February, stayed attached all this time. We dropped WS2N. They stayed all, you know, attached to the space station. They were docked to the Harmony node. Wait a moment, let me think about that. The Earth facing port. And they stayed there for a little, I think it was probably about 5 or 6 weeks. Unloaded about 5,000 pounds of worth of stuff from inside and about 3,000 pounds of stuff in the trunk. Different experiments, equipment that they attached to the outside of the space station. So collectively it was around 7,000 pounds. So they're doing good. They got themselves running, up and running after the September 1st explosion on Launch Complex 40. They launched this particular Dragon from the Launch Complex 39A out of Florida. Now they're getting ready for another. They were getting ready for another launch, and they just did that a couple of days ago. Let me drop it. They launched the first commercial satellite from Launch Complex 39A. That's the famous launch complex that was used for all the Saturn V rockets to the moon and most of the space shuttle missions. And now that's been turned over to SpaceX. So they launched EchoStar. It's a commercial deal, nothing to do with NASA. And they put their EchoStar satellite into geosynchronous orbit. And it was on the heavy side, around 12,000 pounds. So the heaviest thing that SpaceX has put to geosynchronous orbit so far. Delta IV, that'll put up heavier satellites, but for SpaceX it was a record. But to do it, they couldn't, they actually planned not on saving the booster. You know, last 8 flights or so, they've actually saved the booster. It's come down, landed either on land or at sea on a barge, and 3 on land, 5 at sea. One in the Atlantic, and they did it one time in the Pacific Ocean. They landed on a barge out there. But this particular one, they knew that they weren't going to have enough fuel to do that, so they did away with the landing legs. They did away with the fins that they used at the top to control the flight of a booster back down when they are coming back down. Saved a lot of weight, a lot of hardware that they don't need. Basic hardware for handling the booster after it lands. So they have plenty of margin to do what they needed to do. And it worked out good. But that will be the last one that will ever be done like that. In the future, they plan on upgrading that Falcon 9 rocket. Again, they've had different iterations of it since they started launching it. But they plan on getting even more boost out of it. Right now it's 1.7 million pounds. So they started, I think, around 1.2, and they've worked their way up. over the last couple of years, and that eventually is going to be superseded by the Falcon Heavy, which is three Falcon 9s bolted together, strapped together. Again, that will be launched from the same complex, Launch Complex 39A, and that should happen later on this year. So if that goes well, it's just a test flight for SpaceX. They eventually have a contract with the military to put a military...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
This is WS2N timing out. Plenty of other launches going on. Japan just had one. They put a synthetic aperture radar into space for their country. We have Delta Four that just went off the other day. We put them four solid booster rockets attached to that. That put up a military satellite for them. Put that into geosynchronous orbit. See, that was actually a little heavier than the Echo Star one that SpaceX did. And, we have different countries, like I said, Japan, India, launching spacecraft. We have a long list of countries that have put spacecraft around, not only in suborbital flight, but orbital flight, and different spaceports around the world. And I was wondering if there was any more new spaceports. Sure enough, came out the other day that, of all places, that wants to launch satellites probably within about 3 to 4 years, they want to build a spaceport in Canada, in Nova Scotia. Let me drop it. As we all know, the Ukraine has been having a lot of problems, and they're big builders of rockets and rocket engines and things, so they have a rocket that they planned on launching from Brazil, called the Cyclone 4, but that's kind of coming apart with Brazil's economy. They have a launch complex down in Brazil, but have never succeeded in getting anything to orbit. They've had a couple of failures and a couple of serious problems. They just, they feel they're not reliable enough. Ukraine wanted to launch it from their country, but with their problems, they're gonna get Canada to launch their rockets from Nova Scotia. So that was pretty interesting. And the location is right near the water. In fact, it's very close to, they have a building there that was first put up when they started putting underground, underwater cables, to Europe, to Ireland and all, not too far from there. They'll, without a doubt, be able to launch satellites into polar orbit. Geosynchronous would be a little tough, but, if you want a polar launch, why not? Canada would, they'd be able to do it. And I was just wondering if we would be able to see something like that, but I think it would be too far east for us to see anything. Not like the launches from Virginia, from Orbital ATK. Now, they're going to be launching up a rocket very shortly. They're going to be launching another cargo flight to the International Space Station. And that'll be March 24th, which would be, Friday. So that's going to be very interesting. They're not launching it from Virginia. They're launching it from Florida. They have the capability of launching the Cygnus cargo vehicle from two locations, either from Virginia or on the Antares rocket that Orbital ATK builds, or they sub it out to United Launch Alliance down in Florida and have them launch it on a Atlas V rocket. So that's what they plan on doing. Atlas V has a little bit more lift capability, so they'll probably launch a little over 7,300 pounds to the space station. Where if they launch from from Virginia. They usually get around, 5,600, something like that, pounds. So you could do 1,000 or so more pounds by having them do it down in Florida. But that's not going to stop them up here. The next time they launch a cargo vehicle, Orbital ATK will launch from Virginia on the Antares rocket, which is always cool because we get a chance to see that on Long Island. We drop it. There's other topics, Dick, but I just want to talk about this one that we've talked about before, and that has to do with the radiation that people experience in space. NASA's apparently working on a contract with this company. They come out of Israel, but they're developing this chest and body protecting suit, or you can wear on a space station, you can wear on deep space flight, and it's called Astrorad. And by putting this on, you'll protect all your organs, directly connected to you. And this company has developed this for people on Earth. If you're going to work near radiation or something, this type of design has been used by this company for many years now. Now they're designing it, full body. You cover your whole torso with this thing. So it's a form-fitting setup that would completely cover your whole torso. And they believe it would have the capability of really slowing down any kind of radiation problems on a trip to Mars, let's say. So, Astrorad Radiation Shield, they officially call it. It's out of Tel Aviv. Back to you, Dick, for any comments. There's more, but, going through so much, I'll try to cover the main topics that I think would be good. There's a couple of other things. Companies that are having problems, companies that are coming up out of the, joining the rest of the group. You got Rocket Lab going to launch out of New Zealand probably within a month or two. There's so many different things going on. We'll turn it back to you, Dick. This is WS2N for the space portion of the TechNet.
Yeah, one of the things that captured my imagination real fast is the thinking of building a spaceport in Nova Scotia. Wow. That's very far north of the equator, so that definitely limits what orbits you can easily get to. High altitude orbits, that's a great place. And because Nova Scotia has got a lot of water around it, and is it the most eastern part of Nova Scotia? Cape Breton Island, or is it more the center of Nova Scotia, near Halifax? I've got a friend who lives in Halifax, and this is brand new information to me. I presume it's a Canadian concern, thinking of putting up a spaceport. So give us some more words on this one, Paul. And I presume these are going to be fairly high inclination orbits that are going to be launched there efficiently. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, the Cyclone 4 was developed by the Ukraine, and they've launched similar rockets. It used to go under a different name, but it's really going to be called the Cyclone 4. They had a Russian name for it, but now they would like to see Canada do it. Canada's already made some kind of a deal, and they plan on breaking ground within a couple of months, I believe. And it's naturally underwater as far east in Nova Scotia as you can go. The place is called Canaso Hazel Hill area. And it's actually very close to, it's got a couple old buildings, very old buildings, turn of the century. And I mean the last century, when they were putting in underwater cables between that location in New York, and then that location to Ireland. There were a total of a half a dozen underwater cables that went up there. So the place is isolated, like hardly anybody lives up there. they won't have a problem with that. With a problem, something blows up or goes the wrong direction. They always have self-destruct on these things anyway, but you can tell from the map that you could launch directly south, right over the Atlantic, have these boosters drop into the Atlantic, and you'd be on a good polar orbit back here.
So, spell that for me. Where is the website that I can read about this, Paul? And Canaso, Queso Hill area, something like that you pronounced it. Is it the most eastern part of the main island of Nova Scotia? Because Nova Scotia does have a separate little chunk off to the east. It's called Cape Breton. So, I'm looking at it right. And you are saying Nova Scotia, not Newfoundland. So it's really Nova Scotia we're talking about here, Paul. So, I'd like to hear some more words about this place where the spaceport is going to be built. I think you're saying that one of the international cables, undersea cables, had a termination point there. Sounds like it's the most southeastern portion of the Nova Scotia peninsula. Over to you, Paul, K2LAW.
Yeah, okay. I'll give you the name, and if you put it into the computer in a map program, it'll pop up. You'll see it's right on the most eastern side of Nova Scotia. It's Canso Hazel Hill area. Canso is C-A-N-S-O, and Hazel is H-A-Z-E-L, Hill area. That's what they call it, so... I don't see any towns or anything nearby, but there must be something nearby because they've got these old abandoned buildings. I think one's set up as a museum or something. There's like nothing there, but it's they call it the group that's going to be doing it comes out of Canada. It's called the Maritime Launch Service. So they registered to get this thing done. And they would like to launch by 2020. So, it's going to break ground within 1 year. And what website did I get it out of? Oh, goodness, I don't remember. I don't remember. I'll have to track that one down for you, Dick. And when I find it, I'll just send you the email. But this rocket by the Ukraine, they planned on launching originally out of Brazil. Well, the Alcantara. Alcantara was the launch complex. It was called when it was down there, they called it the Alcantara Cyclone Space Project. They had so many problems with that complex. Brazil tried to launch their own rockets. Two of them went off course. And then a third one, people were actually working at the site. Back in the probably early 2000 or something, and one of the rockets went off accidentally somehow, and that in turn blew up the other rockets. You know, I think a group of five rockets on the launch vehicle, and it killed over 120 people. So Brazil has had some problems. They're trying to, they have a bad economy. They're trying to rebuild this place, but meanwhile, the Ukraine wants to, be able to launch polar satellites for commercial reasons too. So, they can't do it, so they're going to make a deal with Canada.
That first word, in the beginning you pronounced it Canaso, then you pronounced it Queso, C-A-S-O. That very first word of something Hazel Hill area. What's that very first word? Spell that slowly for me, Paul. K2LAW.
C-A-N-S-O. So it's Charlie, Alpha, November, Sierra, Oscar. They use a hyphen. Don't know why, but hyphen Hazel. H-A-Z-E-L. Hotel Alpha. Zulu, Echo, Lemur, Hill area. That's the way they refer to it. And when I put that in, comes, you know, it came right up back to there.
Very good. That combined with the maritime launch services, that allowed me to find it. And I'm immediately going to be looking at how close it is to Halifax, where my friend lives. And I'm looking at a map right now that includes United States and Nova Scotia from Long Island. The Great Circle distance, the Great Circle path is about a 45 degree from north. In other words, 45 degrees true from Long Island. You fly that direction continuously, and you'll be flying over Nova Scotia. Keep flying in that direction, you'll fly over Newfoundland also. And in some cases, when it comes to the closest piece of land to Europe, I'm pretty sure that some of those cables have gone to Newfoundland rather than Nova Scotia. And I vaguely remember that, Maynard Hill is the name of the guy who worked at the Applied Physics Laboratory. He made a radio control model airplane with a built-in computer that flew on its own from Newfoundland over to Ireland. He did that a year or two ago. He had made quite a few attempts to do that. So the closest chunk of land to Europe is Newfoundland. So why they would bring an undersea cable from Europe to Nova Scotia instead of Newfoundland is a little bit mysterious to me. But I can see how Nova Scotia could be a very good launch site, because when you aim anything to the southeast from Nova Scotia, boy, you got thousands of miles of Atlantic Ocean. That's also amazing. Let me drop it. That Brazil had a rocket capable of being launched, and because it came back to the site, over 100 people died. 120 people, I think you said. Oh, amazing. Were those the people working at the site, or did it land in a residential area, Paul? And how many years ago was that incident? I don't remember that one. WS2N, K2IW.
A long time ago. I had to be, maybe between 2000 and 2005, I'm guessing. They had built the rocket, and they launched it, and it didn't go well. And, it came back down, probably crashed in the ocean. It was off the east coast of Brazil. And then they did another one. They tried to get it to orbit, and probably went up for about a minute or so, and then that one was lost as well. So then the third one they were building, for some reason, unknown reason, I don't know what happened, of course, too many years ago, and I don't know, maybe they found the cause. As people were working on the site, the rocket was at the launch complex, and I don't know how many engines they had, probably, I'm guessing about 5 engines, but one of them blew, and naturally, I took out the other ones, and the whole thing went up and took out the whole launch complex. But there were technicians and people working there. It wasn't launch day, it's not like they had a launch and the thing blew up. They didn't have a countdown. These people never knew what hit them. They said the whole place was like vaporized. Back to you.
Where in Brazil is that site located, Paul? Is it on the most eastern shore of Brazil, on the Atlantic Ocean?
Yeah, it was. I'm going by memory, but you have your map still up, probably. So the name of it was Alcantara, Brazil. Alcantara. So yeah, you'll find that on the very eastern portion of Brazil. Alcantara. Try putting that in. I'm on a net. I can put it in too, but I have trouble walking and chewing gum at the same time. Back to you.
Right now, there's a rather large number of countries who have either a space program or a launch facility. Wow. And we've got thousands of pieces of satellite-like material, space junk and whatever, in orbit around the Earth right now. Very large number of pieces. But they still fall into the category of LEOs, MEOs, and GEOs. So, can any of these pieces be what I'm talking about? Opaque, round objects drifting across the sun? Not likely. Very unlikely. So, there's a bit of a mystery there, as you can tell. And I'm not sure, but of the serious solar and lunar astronomers, I'll bet you more than 10% of them, maybe as much as 20% of them, if you ask the question the right way, they have seen these objects that I'm talking about. It's not the, we're not talking about 1% of the population. We're talking about of those who do serious lunar and solar observing. Quite a number of them I have talked to have seen these objects from time to time. I happen to be one of them. I've seen them on multiple occasions, by the way, but I won't get into that right now. See ya, Paul. What's the very next launch that NASA's going to be doing that we stand a chance of seeing it? Is it quite a few months away? WS2N, K2IW?
I'll be on the computer on the 24th. No, this Friday they have a launch. That's the Cygnus cargo vehicle going to the International Space Station from Florida on the Atlas V rocket. So, with a 401 configuration, that's on the 4-meter diameter. No solid boosters. But yeah, well, a lot of stuff going up. We went through a list one time, all the different countries. I think it was 12 or so countries. And I guess we could add Canada to the list. You know, you had the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union broke up. And then they had the Kazakhstan. But then Russia really wanted their own. You know, and they had their Plesetsk, I think is the way it's pronounced, up in the north. So Soviet Union had a couple of launch facilities. Now they got one out of the east, eastern Russia, 3,000-4,000 miles away, called Voskhodny. So they've used that a year and a half ago. Well, you know, you got the United States. We have quite a few launch complexes. There's France. They actually used to launch from Algeria. Drop it. Before they got involved with the with South America, with French Guyana. So then French Guyana became very popular. When French, you know, France, and Spain, and Germany, you know, they got together and they called themselves the ESA, the European Space Agency. You've got Japan with two different launch complexes down there. Japan, they just launched the other day. And they launched the synthetic aperture radar for themselves. They want to see what's going on, especially with all the problems in their part of the world. China, countless launches. They're probably doing 20, 30 launches a year. And they have a couple of launch facilities. We drop it. And then before England ever really got involved with the European Space Agency, they are involved, but not as much as let's say Germany or the other countries like France. But they're still involved with the European Space Agency. But they actually launched a satellite or two from Australia back in the early 1970s. India, of course. They have two big rockets that they've been launching, the geosynchronous launch vehicle and the polar satellite launch vehicle, the PSLV. They've been launching that one quite a bit. That was the one that just launched 100 satellites or 104 satellites at one time. He even Iran got into the act, and, I don't know, probably about 8 years ago or so, 8, 9 years ago. And they put a satellite up, but they stopped. But they did it. North Korea recently did it a couple of years ago. That's another country. And now we could add Canada to the list. Not yet, though. Probably 2020. And next month, or probably within another month or two, you're going to have a rocket lab launching from the North Island of New Zealand. So we're going to have more rockets in space than we know what to do with. We won't be able to see the sun after a while. Back to you, Dick. WS1.
Got a long way to go before you block out the sun. Even though you got thousands and thousands of pieces of objects flying in space around the Earth in orbit, there's still an awful lot of empty airspace in between all of those. However, you put something in orbit these days, in theory, you got to calculate where all those pieces of material are, because if you strike one of them, you're going to be unhappy. Some of the closing velocities can be ridiculously high. Of all the launch sites you know of, Paul, the most desirable location for a launch site to put something in orbit around the Earth is as close to the equator as you can get. You get a double benefit out of that. I dropped it. At the equator, your surface velocity is the highest number. It's close to 1,000 miles an hour because of Earth rotation. So you get more velocity toward the east, because the Earth turns from west toward east. And on top of that, some of the most ambitious launches are the ones for geosynchronous satellites. Geostable, geosynchronous. And they got to be directly over the equator. So the closer your launch site is to the equator, the least amount of steering you've got to do after you do launching, because that steering in space is very inefficient. You do steering in the atmosphere, all you got to do is aim your wing in the right direction, and your airplane can easily do a turn. You want to do a turn in space, it's a very expensive maneuver. So of all the launch sites you know of, is the one in Kourou, British Columbia, is it? The one in South America. I think that is a site that's closest to the equator. Is that true, Paul? WS2N, K2IW?
Yeah, French Guiana. That's why, you know, the French actually started, like I said, they launched from Algeria before there was an ESA. So they had a launch complex there. There's nothing left nowadays, but, you know, they abandoned that when the ESA started, and they built everything in French Guiana, which is one of the northern countries down in South America, and it's very close to equator, so you're best off, you know, going from there. There was another launch system that was going for quite a while. I think they did about 20 launches or so, and it was called Sea Launch. Sea Launch was this platform that was used, a floating platform that was used. It left California, from Santa Barbara, and used to float out down to the equator, dropping. And they had a solid booster rocket on board, a large one, you know, and they would float it out there, and they had a support ship. Everybody would get on that. People would be abandoned the launch ship, and this thing would take off and go into geosynchronous orbit right on the equator. You couldn't go wrong. And this was a consortium between Russia and Ukraine and Boeing. So they had a deal. So, you know, they were all partners. But you know what happened with the Ukraine and Russia. So this whole thing started to fall apart some years ago. I don't know, probably 10 years ago, I guess they had problems. So there was a lot of contracts and problems. Boeing wound up, you know, losing a lot of money. So they sued each other. I don't know how they could sue each other across the international lines, but they did. And to make a long story short, this year, or actually last year, now Boeing won. We're dropping. You know, hundreds of millions of dollars. So they have like $350 million deal that they were supposed to be getting. But instead of money being transferred from one, you know, say Russia to Boeing, there's some kind of a, you know, barter system. Boeing's going to make a deal with NASA to arrange for more seats on the Soyuz rocket. You'll notice the next Soyuz rocket that goes up with people in it, they've always had three in it, you know, with the International Space Station. This time it's only going to have two. And that's because Russia's cutting back the people on the space station. We don't have another big lab module that was supposed to be put up there. So we're cutting back. Meanwhile, the United States is, you know, and the European Space Agency, we can't get enough people up there. We need a lot of science that has to be done. In fact, a year or two ago, they were hoping to get it up to seven people instead of a crew of six. But Russia's backing out. They just don't have the, they don't want to put the money into it. But now these seats are available. So Boeing's making some kind of deal with NASA to, you know, we'll shift the money over to you or shift the this seating arrangement. You can now, instead of NASA taking $70 million, that's what it costs, $70 million to give to the Russians for every seat that we use, Boeing's going to start paying for it because they have all these hundreds of millions of dollars now, or the credit of hundreds of millions of dollars. So they're making a deal with NASA to get an extra five seats to go to the space station. And this is it's kind of like an insurance policy. Yeah, we're going to be sending people up within about a year or so on a regular basis on the Dragon crew vehicle and on the Starliner from Boeing, four people at a time. But at the same token, some of those people might eventually be Russians. And we still want to be able to have the capability of sending an American up on their rocket as well. So that's going to continue on. But, you know, all the way till 2024. And hopefully they can keep the station going to 2028. I hope so, but you never know. Back to you, Dick, WS20.
Let's see if we have anybody on deck tonight that wants to ask any further questions on all of the above. Space, ham radio, whatever. Give me your call letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
And so we out.
Rich recognized. Anyone else? N2EO. Go right ahead, Rich. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. Paul, what I wanted to know, in the early days of launching from Vandenberg Air Force Base, are they still using that at all? And where is Vandenberg? I assume Southern California.
Yeah, it is in between what, San Diego and LA, that area. And yeah, Rich, the Vandenberg is still being used. In fact, SpaceX just launched a rocket from there in January, and that was for Iridium Next was the name of the satellites that they put up, and they were 10 satellites. Each satellite weighed 2,000 pounds, so this thing weighed 20,000 pounds, and SpaceX did use that recently in January. It's been used quite a few times by the United Launch Alliance. They just launched a military rocket from there probably, a month or so ago, too. So it's very active. They have a couple of launch complexes. Military launches are, by the United Launch Alliance, your Delta IVs, your Delta IIs, they all go off from, like, Launch Complex 3E. So there's another launch complex called 4E. That one is leased 20 at least by SpaceX. So they keep launching our rockets from there. So it's always been very active. Let me drop it. They have, you know, a 2-3 year lulls here and there. But now it's become more active. At one time, they planned on launching space shuttles from there. In fact, they built the whole launch complex built around the space shuttle. I have old pictures of what it would look like. They took the Enterprise space shuttle, which never flew to space. It did fly from the top of a 747. They said test landed out in the White Sands, New Mexico. And they took that space shuttle. They wanted to see how everything was going to fit and how it was going to look. And they attached it to, the launch complex. And put a mock-up boosters on it. And it was ready to go. And they were going to launch all your military flights from there because they were all going to be polar flights. We dropped it. So Vandenberg was ready to go with the space shuttle. And then they had the space shuttle Challenger. And then right after that, that was it. You know, if Challenger didn't happen, one or two flights after that, they were going to start launching people from Vandenberg. Also, there was a plan even before that, decades before that, they were going to launch people from Vandenberg as well on Gemini-style rockets. Launched them on Gemini-style rockets called the MOLE program, Manned Orbiting Laboratory. But that never took off. But they have used it, and they still are using it for many rocket launches. Back to that WS tour.
I have the impression, Paul, that Vandenberg is used only for near polar orbits. If you wanted to launch a equatorial orbit, I don't think you can do it for Vandenberg, because an equatorial orbit, almost always you launch it to the east, and you launch from Vandenberg toward the east, and you're going to be flying over a residential area. Whereas from Vandenberg, if they launch it due south, because it's going to be a polar orbit, then they're launching over the water. Is that approximately true, Paul? WS2N, K2LAW?
Yeah, all their launches go south and wind up on polar orbits. They go over the South Pole first. And we've launched other rockets from Alaska, Kodiak Island. And they've renamed that place, but it used to be called the Kodiak Launch Complex. And there's been some rockets that have gone off from there. Orbital ATK has launched Minotaur 4 rockets from that location. So we have that location, Vandenberg Air Force Base. Now we have, of course, we always have Cape Canaveral / Kennedy. And, of course, now we have Virginia. So we're not done yet because SpaceX is building another one in Texas. They're in the process of doing that. Probably 2, 3, 4 years from now, you're going to see rockets taking off from near Brownsville, Texas. They're in the process of building a launch complex, all private, for SpaceX. Let me drop it.
Run that by again. Brownsville, Texas. My recollection is that's very far inland. That means some of that launch is going to be over a residential area. Back to you, Paul.
That's just a reference. You know, it's the actual place is called Boca Chica. Boca Chica, Texas. And that's it's right on the borderline. I don't know. You look at the map, it looks like you could walk into Mexico. It's close. Maybe they'll have to go a little further north to get away from the wall that they want to build. It's really right on the border, Dick. So, they've been, last couple of years, they've been bringing back hundreds of thousands of truckloads of dirt and packing down this whole area. The ground just isn't right. When they're done with that, they're going to start erecting towers and buildings. They've already bought the big antenna. They had a big parallel beam. I forget the diameter of it. NASA had it on Merritt Island. They don't need it anymore for tracking rockets taken off, and SpaceX bought it for them, you know, for a dollar or whatever it is, and they took this thing down to Texas, and they're installing that. I think that's installed. But, yeah, they plan on launching their rockets from there. And then we have suborbital launch facilities in Texas, and another one, let me drop it. Another one called Spaceport America. Spaceport America. And that's in New Mexico. And the governor of New Mexico thought this would be a great idea years ago, Richards. Now the people aren't happy about it, but they're paying taxes on it. But, you know, slowly but surely there's people signing up to do stuff down there. Nothing really. There were a couple of little minor suborbital flights. These are going to be all suborbital flights. But I know Virgin Galactic, Richard Branson has got to deal with them. He's going to be the mainstay in that place if he can ever get his spaceship two. Off the ground, that should be pretty good. People paying $200,000 each to sit on a plane to a suborbital flight on the on his rockets. So that's in New Mexico. These things are all over the place, Dick. Back to you.
Yeah, I just looked up Brownsville on the map, and sure enough, it's the most southern tip of Texas, right on the Mexican border, directly on the Gulf of Mexico. So if you do a launch there to the east, you're aiming toward the center of the Gulf of Mexico. Gulf of Mexico. So that's a nice place to do launches from. Huh. Altogether, the United States is going to have quite a few launch sites. It looks like space is going to catch on now, Paul. By the way, the European Space Agency, ESA, has the exact same initials as the European Southern Observatory. Oh, that's USO, ESO. ESA, ESO. No problem. I thought they had similar abbreviations. Hey, with any further questions for Paul on space or anyone else with reference to ham radio, and tonight we're even into astronomy. So you're allowed to ask your questions on astronomy, space, and ham radio. Give me your call letters right now, K2RIW, the TechNet.
RYY.
You got it, Joe.
Good evening, again, the B4YY. I heard that one of these companies, I don't remember exactly which, but I think 2020 is looking to do a pilotless rendezvous around the moon taking some passengers. Have you heard much about that? And how much is that going to cost per person? Back to you, or Paul.
You've got it, Paul.
Yeah, Joe, that was SpaceX. Elon Musk made that announcement, a few weeks ago, I guess. And he's got plans on taking two people. They're going to pay, you know, it's private money. They want to pay SpaceX to get on to a Dragon crewed vehicle to launch from Complex 39A in Florida on a Falcon 9 Heavy. Elon Musk calls it a FH. He calls it a Falcon Heavy. He's dropped a 9 of them. It's essentially 27 engines that are going to be over the Earth. And he's got another one of those 27 engines for a second stage. He calls them Merlin engines, Merlin D. And it's going to blast them to the moon. And without having to orbit the moon, it's not going to slow down like they did with Apollo. It's not going to slow down and go into orbit around the moon. He's just going to make a big figure eight around the moon and go out probably about 30,000 miles past the moon. And then slowly come back again. Come back to the Earth at 25,000 miles per hour. Let me drop it. And have parachutes open and land in the ocean. Long-term plans are eventually to have propulsive landing. No parachutes, just come back with a heat shield and come back to land. So he's got two people lined up that approached him. I guess they have a lot of money. We don't know what it's going to cost, and we don't know who the people are. All we know is the two people know each other. So this should be interesting as it develops. And I, like I said, he predicts these things. He gets things done, but all it takes is one other problem during the year or something to throw him off. He's had two explosions of Falcon 9s within a 14-month period, and each time it slows him down for 4 or 5 months. We drop him. The crewed vehicle, Dragon crewed vehicle, hasn't flown yet. The one that's been going up 10 times docked to the space station so far is the Dragon cargo vehicle. But modeled after that one is this Dragon crewed vehicle that he's going to be using. He's also making another version of the cargo vehicle that's going to the space station. Some years from now, he plans on bringing the cargo vehicle back with propulsive landing, no parachutes, back to land, and that'll be his preliminary tries to do that successfully. And if that works out, then he'll switch over to people. Now, he thinks he can do this, Joe, on a regular basis, you know, two times a year. We drop it. He plans on, you know, in the long run, doing these flights two times a year, putting two people on board, shooting them around the moon and bringing them back. And he thinks that will be a big contributing factor, you know, financial, beneficially. I think he said 20% of the income for the, you know, for the space industry could come from these flights. So we'll see what happens. He's not the only one planning these weird things. NASA plans on maybe using the SLS to, and Orion to do the same thing one time on the drop. Also sending two people around the moon and bringing them back on the first trip using the SLS. The SLS is supposed to launch on in 2018. If it becomes a crewed vehicle, that will be delayed until 2019. Not to be topped by them, Jeff Bezos, the owner of Amazon, is building something called the New Glenn. The New Glenn, I mean, it's almost as big as the Saturn V rocket, and he's building he's got the facility pretty much built down in Florida that's going to make these rockets. And he plans on eventually putting people on his rockets as well. And with that kind of rocket, you could send them to the moon or Mars or someplace. Back to you, Dick, WSUN.
Didn't the Saturn V rocket series, wasn't that originally, I think one of the main designers of that was Wernher von Braun, and if so, he had a pretty good track record, because I rarely heard of any of his stuff ever blowing up. He was a real rocket scientist. Back to you.
Well, yeah, sure. The F-1 was being designed in the late 1950s. So it was being designed as just a heavy lift rocket. They were really, you know, government really wasn't planning on using it. But they were kind of scrapping that idea. And Von Braun said, you know, you got these things in development, let's use the F-1. And he eventually perfected the F-1, his design. And eventually he wound up with five of those engines pushing the envelope. I mean, think about the power of each F-1 engine. It was five of them. Each one was 1.5 million pounds of thrust out of one liquid, you know, kerosene-driven engine. Unbelievable. Like I mentioned earlier, and then that SpaceX launched a rocket, put a satellite, private satellite, into geosynchronous orbit with a Falcon 9. 39A, that rocket had 1.7 million. So let's call it 1.5 million. It's just not too long ago, it was around 1.5 million. That's the nine engines. Let me drop it. That's the nine engines. Well, Von Braun, he was with the F1 engine. He developed that thing.
it was developing the same amount of thrust, just for 1 inch, 1.5 million pounds of thrust, and then